7 p.m., Eurus knocked at his mother's door and got no answer. He pounded on the locked door, first annoyed, then increasingly worried. She had sounded depressed on the phone the night before. Finally, he threw his weight against the door twice and broke it open. Inside, he found Anna lying on her back on the bathroom floor with the blue silk cord of her robe tied in a tight, exaggeratedly large bow around her neck. He called the police, then his sister in Maryland, to say he believed their mother had committed suicide. It soon became clear, though, that this was not the case. Boston PD homicide detectives James Mellon and John Driscoll arrived and found the victim in a blue taffeta housecoat with red lining, but it had been spread completely apart in front so that she was exposed from her shoulders down. She lay grotesquely, her head a few feet from the open bathroom door, her left leg stretched straight and the right spread wide, bent at the knee. There was blood on her right ear and a laceration on the back of her skull. Her neck was scratched and abraded, and there was a contusion on her chin. The apartment had been ransacked. Anna's purse was lying open, and its contents strewn on the floor. Waste baskets had been turned over, and dresser drawers pulled open and messed around with, as if the killer just wanted to handle her personal items. A case of color slides had been carefully placed on the bedroom floor. The record player was on, but the sound had been turned off. Despite this attempt to make the scene look like a robbery, a gold watch and other pieces of jewelry had been left untouched. The autopsy showed that Anna Slessers had died from strangulation, complicated by head injuries. Her vagina showed evidence of sexual assault with some hard object, possibly a bottle. Victimology revealed a woman completely involved in her church, her children, her work, and her love of classical music. Divorced, she kept to herself and had few friends. There were no men in her life outside from her son. Police figured the crime had started out as a burglary, but when the burglar saw the woman in her robe, he was overcome by an urge to molest her, killing her afterward to avoid being identified. Between that June 14, 1962, that Anna Slessers was murdered, and January 4, 1964, 13 single women in the Boston area became victims of one or more serial killers. At least 11 could be tied to the same unsub, who became known as the Phantom Fiend or the Boston Strangler. Most were strangled with their own stockings or other items found on the premises, such as pillowcases, scarves, bras, or other clothing. Within 10 weeks, 6 women had been murdered, the first 4 within 27 days, then 2 more in August, 9 days apart. All were older victims. Anna Slessers had been the youngest by 10 years, and the second victim, Mary Mullen, was 85. A second wave began in December 1962 with much younger victims, one just 21. Then a third wave ran from September 1963 to January 1964. These women were also younger. One of the complications with the Strangler case is found in the Zodiac murders discussed in the last chapter. As the body count rises, there is a tendency to link future cases to a series, appropriately or not, and this certainly muddied the waters here. In the crimes listed above, except for one woman who was killed in a hotel room, all of the victims were murdered in their apartments. All had been sexually molested. With no signs of forced entry, each victim apparently knew her assailant, voluntarily let him in, or failed to lock a door. Most of the women led quiet, modest lives. The Boston community lived in terror. Warnings went out to all women to keep their doors locked and to be wary of strangers. For a time, police commissioner and former FBI agent Edmund McNamara canceled all leave and transferred every available detective to homicide. A thorough investigation was conducted of all known sex offenders and violent former mental patients. More than 36,000 people were examined, and suspect lists ran into the thousands. Hundreds were fingerprinted and 40 polygraphed. 6 of them failed. But police were no closer to their killer. Toward what would prove to be the end of the Strangler series in 1964, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire were being terrorized by a rapist who became known as the Green Man because he was generally dressed in dark green clothing of the type workmen might wear. He would either talk his way into a woman's home by claiming he was there to repair something, or else break in. On one occasion, he raped 4 women in a single day. Police believed he might have been responsible for as many as 300 sexual assaults, and the fear was so great that legitimate repairmen and deliverymen were being refused admittance. The green man would threaten his victim with a knife, caress her, then rape her. But he conducted himself in a friendly, almost casual way, and would often apologize before he left. In October of 1964, he broke into the bedroom of a 20-year-old woman in Cambridge, Massachusetts, threatened her with a knife, tied her up, raped her, then asked for her forgiveness. He was about to leave when she complained that he had tied her painfully tight, so he loosened the binding. This woman helped police produce a sketch good enough that it triggered a memory from one detective. The green man looked like the Measuring Man. The Measuring Man had worked the Cambridge area 3 years before, back in 1961. He would surveil attractive young women, then knock on their door, claiming to be from a modeling agency. Saying he was looking to sign up new talent, he would ask if he could take body measurements. That was all he would do. Then he would leave. Most of the women didn't even realize there was anything strange about this until there was no follow-up from the agency. In March 1961, Cambridge PD arrested a man attempting to break into a house. He fit the description and confessed to being the Measuring Man. Albert Henry DeSalvo was a 29-year-old factory worker and Army veteran who lived in nearby Malden with his German-born wife and two small children. He had numerous arrests for breaking into apartments and stealing whatever money he could find. When asked why he perpetrated this odd and distasteful measuring charade, he responded, "I'm not good-looking, I'm not educated, but I was able to put something over on high-class people. They were all college kids, and I never had anything in my life, and I outsmarted them." He was sentenced to 18 months in prison and released in April of 1962, 2 months before Anna Slessers was found strangled. He told his parole officer he required sex at least 6 times a day, but no one suggested he seek or receive psychiatric help. DeSalvo was born on September 3, 1931, in Chelsea, Massachusetts, one of 6 children. His father, Frank, was a violently abusive man who regularly beat his wife and children. Frank also brought prostitutes home and had sex with them in front of his family. At 5 or 6, Albert played sex games with his brothers, no great surprise in light of his father's example. Albert developed some sadistic compulsions, which manifested themselves in cruelty to small animals. Throughout his adolescence, he went through periods of delinquency and petty criminality, interspersed with periods of good behavior and staying out of trouble. His relationship with his mother, Charlotte, was reasonably good. Albert was in the Army from 1948 through 1956 and stationed for a time in Germany, where he met his wife, Irmgard Beck, an attractive woman from a respected family. He'd been promoted to a specialist E5, but was demoted back to private for failure to obey an order. In 1955, he was arrested for fondling a young girl, but the charge was dropped. That same year, his first child, Judy, was born with a congenital pelvic disease. This had a large impact on DeSalvo's home life. Irmgard, terrified she would have another child with a handicap, tried to avoid sex, while Albert had a voracious sexual appetite. He received an honorable discharge from the service. Between 1956 and 1960, he had several arrests for breaking and entering, but each time received a suspended sentence. In 1960, a son, Michael, was born without handicaps. In spite of his brushes with the law, DeSalvo managed to stay employed. He was a press operator at a rubber factory, then worked in a shipyard, then as a construction worker. Most people who knew Albert DeSalvo liked him, and one boss characterized him as a decent family man and good worker. Unlike his own father, Albert treated his wife and children with love and consideration. Police arrested DeSalvo at home for the Green Man crimes. He was mortified that Irmgard would see him in handcuffs, but she urged him to tell the truth. He admitted to breaking into 400 apartments and to assaulting some 300 women in the 4-state area. Given his tendency to self-aggrandize, it was difficult to know if the number was actually anywhere near that high. On February 4, 1965, DeSalvo was sent by the court to Bridgewater State Hospital for psychiatric evaluation. Shortly thereafter, George Nassar, charged with the vicious execution-style murder of a gas station attendant, also came to Bridgewater. He had a high IQ and the ability to manipulate. The two men were placed in the same ward, and he became Albert's confidant. Around that time, a police detective had come to Bridgewater to take DeSalvo's handprint for the Boston Strangler investigation. Soon Albert was telling people that, indeed, he was the Strangler. Nassar contacted his own attorney, the soon-to-be-famous F. Lee Bailey, who met with DeSalvo in prison, even though DeSalvo was at the time represented by another lawyer. Bailey was able to obtain unreleased information on the Strangler cases from Boston PD, so he could learn what DeSalvo actually knew. He taped an interview, then played it for the police. Bailey said he was convinced Albert DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler. Ultimately, the police came to the same conclusion. Now there was a larger issue to contend with. How to deal with a self-confessed killer and the people's demand for justice. With Bailey as his counsel, DeSalvo went to trial on January 10, 1967, not for the Boston Strangler murders, but for the Green Man assaults and break-ins. During the trial, Bailey conceded that DeSalvo was the Strangler so as to earn him a spot in a mental institution instead of a penitentiary. DeSalvo was found guilty of the Green Man crimes and sentenced to life in prison. While he was awaiting transfer to Walpole State Prison, DeSalvo escaped from Bridgewater with two other inmates and stayed out for 36 hours before turning himself in. Though the entire area was terrified that the Boston Strangler was free, he said he just wanted to show his desire to go into a mental institution. The Boston Strangler phenomenon was huge. A book by Gerald Frank became a bestseller. A movie starred Tony Curtis and Henry Fonda. F. Lee Bailey became a celebrity and legal star. And from prison, Albert DeSalvo, the Measuring Man and the Green Man, basked in his notoriety as an American nightmare. On December 27, 1973, DeSalvo was stabbed to death in the infirmary at Walpole. The murder was believed to be related to his involvement in a prison drug operation. Three inmates were tried, but twice the trials ended in hung juries. The controversy over whether DeSalvo actually was the Boston Strangler lives on long after him. From all of my study of serial sexual offenders, I believe it is virtually impossible that Albert DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler. Why not? He was there at the time. He was mobile in the way the Strangler was. He had already demonstrated his proficiency at breaking and entering, his voracious sexual appetite, and his willingness to rape. He certainly had the kind of abusive background you'd expect to see in a sexual predator. So what's missing? Behavior. Through a lot of research and case experience, we at the FBI's National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime at Quantico have divided rapists into four major categories: the power reassurance rapist, the exploitative rapist, the anger rapist, and the sadistic rapist. There can be some overlap and crossover, just as there is with organized and disorganized criminal behavior, but these categories hold up well in providing insight into the type of personality who commits a given sexual crime. Simply stated, the power reassurance rapist is someone who feels himself to be inadequate and compensates for this by forcing women to have sex with him. The exploitive rapist is an impulsive predator who seizes an opportunity when it comes along. He is very conscious of his body and ego and, unlike the power reassurance rapist, will be unconcerned with the victim's feelings. The anger rapist, also known as the anger retaliatory rapist, uses sexual assault as a displaced expression of the rage and anger within him. The victim might represent a mother, wife, girlfriend, or even a group of people whom the offender hates. The sadistic rapist attacks because of sexual fantasies involving dominating, controlling, and hurting other people. Depending on his fantasies and preferences, the victim might be subjected to normal vaginal intercourse or anything in the range of perversity, including torture and or death. The only thing that really matters to him is dominating the victim and making her suffer for his own pleasure and satisfaction. As should be clear, though all forms of sexual attack are horrible and heinous, the anger rapist and the sadistic rapist will tend to be the most dangerous. All of the evidence in the Green Man crimes suggests that the perpetrator was a power reassurance rapist. He threatened his victims to get his way, but did not attack them with his knife. He talked to them and was apologetic. In an admittedly weird and self-centered way, he seemed concerned for their welfare. This type of behavior squares with DeSalvo's background as the Measuring Man. A power reassurance rapist will generally start out with so-called nuisance crimes, such as voyeurism, and as he gets older and a little more confident, will evolve into less benign activities that are still nonviolent. The important consideration is that this type of personality does not evolve into an anger retaliatory or sadistic offender. Even DeSalvo's background gives him away on this. He hated his father but had good relationships with his mother and wife. This is not the hallmark of an anger rapist. But with the precipitating stressor of the birth of a sick child and his wife's resultant antipathy to sex, we have all the motivation we need for the evolution into a power reassurance rapist. If we look at the Boston Strangler murders, we see clear evidence of a sadistic rapist at work. He not only targeted young women, but older, more vulnerable ones. He not only raped, but beat them. He strangled them with articles of their own clothing. He depersonalized them. He posed them in such a way as to degrade the victims and shock whoever came upon the crime scene. From a behavioral perspective, everything about these two sets of crimes is different. Keep in mind that the Green Man was still operating after Anna Slessers was killed. There is no way DeSalvo or any other killer could have de-escalated from such a brutal murder back to the kind of assaults the Green Man was committing. Albert DeSalvo was not an angry or sadistic guy. If he were, this behavior would have shown up in other aspects of his life, and it would certainly have shown up in his interactions in prison. Though DeSalvo wouldn't have committed crimes as savage and sadistic as those of the Boston Strangler, it is understandable that once the suggestion was made to him, he'd take credit for the crimes. If he's power reassurance motivated, then anything that puts him in a more macho light can be appealing to him. If he's looking for status, he knows he's not going to find it as a brain surgeon, a movie star, or a pro athlete. And one way or another, he's not getting back out on the street anytime soon. But in the milieu in which he's used to operating, if he can be perceived as a celebrity criminal, well, at least he's a somebody. If DeSalvo was taking credit for crimes he did not commit, it was not the first time. He had claimed responsibility for a robbery and assault in Rhode Island in 1964, though someone else was identified by the victim and arrested for the crime. As to how he could have gained specific information on the Strangler murders, he later said he was so fascinated by the press accounts that in some cases he used his burglary skills and broke into the victim's apartments just to look around. Other than for George Nassar, we can't be sure whom DeSalvo had extensive contact with at Bridgewater, but it is clear that he easily could have been fed additional information on the Strangler crimes. It is also possible that Bailey might unintentionally have asked him leading questions. Much was published in the papers, and though DeSalvo wasn't the brightest guy in the world, he was known for his excellent memory. Not only that, Albert's own extensive experience as a burglar allowed him to intuit some of the right answers just because he knew how an intruder would have acted. Even so, DeSalvo still got a number of Strangler details wrong or didn't remember at all. No witness ever identified DeSalvo in connection with any of the Strangler crime scenes, and no physical evidence connects him to any of the murders. No one else has ever been tried for the Boston Strangler murders. A number of accomplished detectives never believed DeSalvo was a strangler, and in fact, thought there was more than one offender. A number of reasonable alternative suspects have emerged over the years, including George Nassar himself, a criminally sophisticated convicted murderer with a high IQ who has admitted to having killed for excitement. However, he has steadfastly denied that he was the strangler, and no official attempt has been made to tie him to the crimes. New York Police Lieutenant Thomas Cavanaugh believed he discovered the identity of the strangler through a 1963 homicide he investigated, the strangling of a 62-year-old woman tied to Charles A. Terry, 23 at the time, and a native of Waterville, Maine. Terry had been in Boston during the first six strangler murders, and evidence from the New York crime scene matched many of the Boston details, including positioning of the body, strangulation with a scarf, and tying the bow. He had been diagnosed as a psychopath and sexual sadist and had a history of assaults against women. He died in prison of lung cancer in 1981. After the August 20, 1962 murder of 67-year-old Jane Sullivan, the sixth strangler victim, George Snubbs, a man with a deviant sexual history, committed suicide several blocks from Sullivan's apartment by tying a bow around his neck with a pair of stockings. After his death, the age range of the Strangler's targeted victims shifted from older women to younger ones. A man whose stay at Bridgewater overlapped with DeSalvo's was a suspect in the deaths of Anna Slessers, Jane Sullivan, and three others of the first wave of murders, since he was missing from Boston State Hospital on those dates. A diagnosed psychotic with a low IQ, he had tried to kill his mother, whom he regularly punched and kicked. He reportedly told his sister that he was the strangler. And then there was another inmate at Bridgewater whose stay overlapped DeSalvo's by 5 weeks. He was a university student in the Boston area during the Strangler murders. Another diagnosed psychotic and possible schizophrenic, he had an extremely high IQ, as well as a history of drug abuse and petty crime. He had been arrested for abusing his pregnant wife. Friends said he was subject to wild fits of anger and violence, and claimed he said he would save the world by destroying its women. His move from Boston to the Midwest coincided with 7 brutal sexual murders there, in 2 of which stockings were tied around the victim's neck. There is no evidence that Albert DeSalvo had any knowledge or insight as to the true identity of the Boston Strangler or Stranglers. He acknowledged the mystery, at the same time adding to his own mythology and mystique, with a poem he composed in prison. It ends, "Today he sits in a prison cell. Deep inside, only a secret he can tell. People everywhere are still in doubt. Is the Strangler in prison or roaming about?" Chapter 6. The JonBenet Ramsey Murder. In the JonBenet Ramsey murder case, many of the themes we've been dealing with come together. Family, celebrity, personality evaluation, the suffering of the most innocent among us, kidnapping, brutal, sustained aggression killing, and the appearance of raw evil where we least expect to find it. It is also the one case in this book with which I have had extensive personal involvement. And since I am personally involved, it's probably necessary to say a couple of things up front. My purpose here is neither to defend or condemn John or Patricia Ramsey, nor to justify the actions or positions for which, in certain circles, I have been roundly criticized and my motives challenged. My purpose is only to explain how I reached the conclusions I did through the use of the criminal investigative analysis that I helped develop over a quarter of a century. As I've stated on many occasions, murder is the single most disturbing and devastating experience that can happen to any of us, because murder, unlike death by disease or accident, is an intentional act, one that turns our world upside down and robs us of all of our basic orientations to the world except, if we are very fortunate, our faith. And this particular murder is among the most horrifying of all, both because of its beautiful 6-year-old victim and because of the horrendous evil it implies by raising the possibility that a father or a mother could be capable of killing his or her own child. The case is also noteworthy, virtually unique, for other reasons as well. Many crimes are tried in the court of public opinion long before they reach a court of law. The Borden, Lindbergh, and Simpson-Goldman murders, to name just a few. But I know of no other case in which the majority of people have decided the solution based on statistics. I know of no other case in which the public substantially believes what has been reported in the tabloids. I know of no other case in which the mainline media have let the tabloids take the lead and then reported on their reporting. And I know of no other case in which largely respectable television programs have so tried to outdo each other in sensationalism. I would not be so exercised, except this is so clearly and fundamentally the enemy of fairness and justice. Am I saying I alone have the inside track on those two ideals? By no means. Nobody knows for certain what happened on the night of December 25, 1996, that caused the unnatural and violent death of JonBenet Patricia Ramsey, except for the person or persons who perpetrated it. All that any of the rest of us can do is to make our best judgment based on our common sense, analysis, and whatever expertise and experience we can bring to bear. If I am vilified for coming out and stating what I believe to be true, so be it. It won't be the first time, and doubtless will not be the last. I had already experienced this reaction when I was called to Atlanta in 1980 during the horrifying string of child murders. I came away with the police pissed off at me for moving in on their territory, and the public rejecting my suggestion that the killings of black children wasn't an organized conspiracy of hate by the Ku Klux Klan, but the work of a lone and inadequate young black man. That's the nature of the business. But the important point I want to make here is that a criminal investigation is not a popularity contest. It is not, nor should it be, directed or determined by public opinion or media influence. Some have called me a hired gun in this case, and it is true that I received a small fee early on, as I have in certain other cases in which I have consulted since leaving the Bureau. Some have called me a publicity hound, and it is true that I have never been shy around a camera, particularly in the days when I was trying to get the FBI's profiling program off the ground and would seek publicity from just about anywhere, both to support the program and to elicit the public's help on individual cases. But I have never, ever offered an opinion that wasn't deeply felt and fully supported by my own belief and the facts as I saw them. A defense attorney has the responsibility of making a case for his client's innocence, whether he believes in that innocence or not. A criminal investigator has only one responsibility, and it is an extremely solemn one. It has to do neither with whom he or she works for, nor who is signing the paycheck. It should have nothing to do with personal glory or career advancement. It has only to do with the silent pledge made by the investigator to the victim, who can no longer speak for herself, that he or she will do everything within his or her power to uncover the truth of what happened and bring the offender to the gates of earthly justice. There is not enough money or fame in the entire world to lure me away from the enormity and seriousness of that pledge. And I am far from alone in this. I believe in the sincerity of that pledge no less vehemently with regard to former Detective Steve Thomas, with whose interpretation I disagree radically, than with Detective Lou Smith, with whom I am in much more basic agreement to name but two participants in this case. I believe both men to be of solid integrity, and to want nothing more or less than justice for JonBenet. I hope they regard me the same way. With that off my chest, let's look carefully at the Ramsey case, and why it has haunted us so profoundly. I don't think we can deny that we became obsessed with this one because the victim was so young, blonde, and beautiful, the parents rich and prominent and intelligent, the neighborhood fashionable and safe, the community secure and self-satisfied, and the timing, Christmas. All these elements suggest a crime like this should not have occurred. If ever there was a man-bites-dog case, this is it. Even her unique name, a combination of her father's given names coupled with her mother's first name, added to the mystique. And let us be plain, the first time we saw those beauty pageant images of the mini Las Vegas showgirl, the pint-sized cowboy sweetheart, and the patriotic red, white, and blue bedecked tap-dancing tot, eyes always full of fun and mischief, and hand resting confidently on a cocked hip, they were instantly and indelibly etched on our collective memory. District Attorney Alex Hunter offered the opinion that it was this pageant film that separates this case from 2,000 other child homicides. In a bizarre and perverse mockery of our cult of celebrity, in death, JonBenet became America's greatest cover girl. December 25th to 26th, 1996. So how are we going to approach this case? Regardless of who the killer is, we've got to deal with the facts as they were. We've got to be able to track a family from a morning of gifts and visiting and childish delight, through a happy and fun-filled Christmas dinner with good friends and the anticipation of an early morning flight on their private plane to their vacation home, to the garroting, blunt force trauma, sexual assault, and fatal sustained aggression against a 6-year-old last known to be asleep in her bed. Those are the facts. Any participants and motives we attempt to plug into the scenario must work with those facts. For law enforcement, the case began at 5:52 a.m. on December 26, 1996, when a Boulder, Colorado police dispatcher took the following 911 emergency call from Patricia Ann Ramsey. Ramsey, inaudible, Police. Dispatcher. Inaudible. Ramsey. 755 15th Street. Dispatcher. What's going on there, ma'am? Ramsey. We have a kidnapping. Hurry, please. D. Explain to me what's going on, okay? R. There, we have a... There's a note left, and our daughter's gone. D. A note was left, and your daughter is gone? R. Yes. D. How old is your daughter? R. She's 6 years old. She's blonde. 6 years old. D. How long ago was this? R. I don't know. I just found the note and my daughter's... Inaudible. D. Does it say who took her? R. What? D. Does it say who took her? R. No. I don't know. It's there. There's a ransom note here. D. It's a ransom note? R. It says, SBTC Victory. Please. D. Okay, what's your name? Are you? R. Patsy Ramsey. I'm the mother. Oh, my God, please. D. I'm... Okay, I'm sending an officer over, okay? R. Please. D. Do you know how long she's been gone? R. No, I don't. Please, we just got up, and she's not here. Oh, my God, please. D. Okay. R. Please send somebody. D. I am, honey. R. Please. D. Take a deep breath. Inaudible. R. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Inaudible. D. Patsy? 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 Within a few minutes, Boulder PD officer Rick French arrived at 755 15th Street, a large red brick Tudor-style house in the city's University Hill neighborhood. The exterior of the house was elaborately decorated for Christmas. He was met at the front door by the missing child's mother, Patricia Ramsey, 3 days short of her 40th birthday, attired in a red sweater and black slacks. They were joined shortly by the father, John Bennett Ramsey, 53 years of age, dressed in a blue and white striped shirt and khaki slacks. Patsy was John's second wife. His first marriage to the former Lucinda Lou Pash had ended in divorce, and he and Patsy had been married for 16 years. Officer French's impression was that Patsy appeared agitated and distraught, while John appeared tense, but calm and controlled. Their nearly 10-year-old son, Burke, had not yet been awakened. They told French that Patsy had come down from her third-floor bedroom around 5:45 a.m. to awaken 6-year-old John Binet and to begin getting everything ready for their flight to Charlevoix, Michigan, where their vacation home was located. From there, they had planned to fly to Florida to take Burke and John Binet on a cruise on Disney's Big Red Boat. John Binet's bedroom was empty. Patsy then descended the back spiral staircase outside the child's room on the second floor. On one of the lower steps, she noted 3 sheets of lined, white legal paper laid side by side. They showed French the communication, now laid out on the wooden floor of the hallway outside the kitchen. Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We, cross out, respect your business, misspelled, but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession, misspelled. She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. Make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the, page 2, money, and hence an earlier, cross out, pickup of your daughter. Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you not to provoke them. Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions, page 3, and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Victory. SBTC. The note was written with a black felt-tip marking pen, and the blocky handwriting appeared to belong to someone who was either extremely nervous or consciously attempting to disguise his or her normal style, possibly by writing with the non-dominant hand. Before long, the patrol supervisor, Sergeant Paul Reichenbach, came to the house. The note had warned against notifying the police, something just about any parent would do regardless of the threat, and if the house was under surveillance or scrutiny, as the note said, the presence of two marked patrol cars would have been quite obvious. Along with Reichenbach, two sets of the Ramseys' close friends, Fleet and Priscilla White, and John and Barbara Fernie, responded to Patsy's frantic phone calls and came over. The Whites had hosted the Christmas dinner the previous evening. It was the second year that the Ramseys and the Whites had spent Christmas together. Reichenbach called for more personnel, including a crime scene evidence team and someone from the victim witness office. He instructed the telephone company to institute a trap and trace on the Ramseys' line, then notified the detective supervisor on call, Sergeant Robert Whitson. He directed that there be no further police radio traffic in case the kidnappers had access to a police scanner. Reichenbach conducted a quick survey of the house, including JonBenet's room. He found no obvious signs of forced entry. His observations were consistent with French's. Patsy was verging on hysteria, while John was calm and composed. According to witnesses, they did not seem to interact much, especially once the Whites and Fernies arrived. The two women took Patsy into the sunroom off the living room to sit with her and comfort her. Now, even at this early stage, we're already starting to see some problems with the investigation. The premises from which a victim has presumably been kidnapped are a crime scene and must be treated as such to preserve potential crucial clues. All investigators operate according to the theory of transfer, which states that no one enters or exits a room without leaving something behind and taking something away. Therefore, the more people at a scene, and this includes police officers, the more corrupted the scene will be. It is perfectly understandable that the Ramseys would want their closest friends around them, and commendable that the police would want them to have this emotional support during their ordeal, but valuable evidence already could have been destroyed. The first choice would be to remove everyone from the house and take them to the police station or some other location, and to secure the house and grounds. If that was not deemed practical for whatever reason, such as the need to wait for a phone call from the kidnapper, and if everyone had to be there, then they needed to be contained in one place where they would not corrupt the entire scene. They should not have been allowed to wander the house freely, particularly an obviously critical area such as JonBenet's bedroom. Unfortunately, these mistakes would be compounded as the morning wore on. At one point, Fleet White attempted to help out by conducting his own search. On the far wall of a storage room in the labyrinthine basement, a small broken window immediately caught his attention. In another part of the basement, White also walked through the small furnace room toward a door to another storage room the Ramseys referred to as the wine cellar, even though they were both very light drinkers. It was completely dark when White opened the door, and he could not find a light switch, so he reclosed the door and returned upstairs. There, John Ramsey explained that he himself had broken the window Fleet had seen some months earlier when he'd returned to the empty house without his key. By this time, the two victim advocates had arrived to offer emotional support for the Ramseys and to act as liaisons with the police. But this further complicated the scene, and as one officer left the house to bring the ransom note to police headquarters, the Ramseys' pastor, the Reverend Raul Hoverstock, of St. John's Episcopal Church, also arrived. During this time, Burke Ramsey was awakened and told that his sister was missing. He dressed and was taken from the house to the Whites. John and Patsy wanted him removed from the tension and trauma as much as possible, but this action could be criticized. If John Bonet had presumably been kidnapped by unknown parties for unknown reasons, how much sense does it make to bring Burke to an unsecured location? Why did the police accede to it? As with many aspects of this case, at least two explanations are possible. On the positive side, we could say that in times like this, under this incredible stress, you tend to think in a linear, immediate result-oriented manner. John and Patsy didn't want Burke traumatized for life by what he might experience here, and so they wanted him taken to the place he felt most comfortable and safe. The police agreed to this because they were sensitive to the same things the Ramseys were. The negative interpretation would hold that if one or both of the Ramseys had been the perpetrator, they would know that Burke was in no danger away from them. And the negative judgment on the police would be that they blew it. They never should have let a potential victim and or material witness out of their protection. Yet one, that is the Ramseys or the police, could easily reason that if the kidnapper had wanted Burke, he would have taken him at the same time he took Jean Benet. And at the White's house, Burke would be under constant visual supervision by people who genuinely cared for him, and no one is going to brazenly break in broad daylight and grab him. My decades of experience investigating kidnappings and murders tells me that the proper explanation cannot be determined in a vacuum. Each element must be fit into an overall pattern, which is what we'll attempt to do. Sergeant Whitson put detectives on the case, then informed the Boulder County Sheriff's Department and the District Attorney's Office, in the person of Peter Hofstrom, Chief of the Felony Division. According to Steve Thomas, the detective who was to play a major role in the investigation, a canine unit with a tracking dog was also put on standby, but for some reason was never used. Thomas considers this another mistake, and I agree. I have been impressed by the ability of tracking dogs to follow even a faint scent from a given point to where the victim was next taken. John Ramsey called his friend Rod Westmoreland, an attorney and vice president of Merrill Lynch's Atlanta office, to arrange for the ransom money. John and Patsy had met in Atlanta and lived there until John's successful regional computer distribution company, MicroSouth, merged with two others to form Access Graphics, with the central office to be located in Boulder. John moved there to become chief executive. Patsy and the children followed after Patsy found the 1920s house on 15th Street. Patsy's father, Donald Paw, a former Union Carbide executive, worked for John's company in Atlanta and also moved to Boulder. Access, which topped $1 billion in annual sales, was then sold to Lockheed Martin, which kept John as chief executive. In spite of the relocation of the family out west, the Ramseys still essentially considered themselves Atlantans, and Patsy, a native West Virginian who had represented the state in the Miss America pageant, missed many aspects of the Southern lifestyle. Westmoreland, tracked down at his parents' home in Tupelo, Mississippi, quickly went to work on the money. He called back to tell John he had arranged for a $118,000 credit line on his Visa card, which would translate to a cash advance at any local bank. Needless to say, any time the phone rang, the police immediately snapped to attention, expecting that it might be the kidnapper calling. A little after 8 a.m., Sergeant Whitson contacted John Eller, commander of the Boulder PD Detective Division. Like so many other people at this time of year, Eller was out of town, vacationing with his family in Florida. Within a few minutes of this call, Detectives Linda Arndt and Fred Patterson arrived on scene, having already seen the ransom note and been apprised of the situation thus far. From all accounts, Arndt treated the Ramseys with great compassion and consideration, trying to reassure Patsy as best she could. She instructed John on how to react when the kidnapper called, stressing that he should try to keep him on the line as long as possible. John called Michael Archuleta, the private pilot who was to fly the Ramsey plane, a 1972 twin-engine Beechcraft King Air C-90, to Charlevoix, Michigan, and told him what had happened. Archuleta had worked extensively with John, and they considered each other good friends. John's two older children from his first marriage, Melinda and John Andrew, and Melinda's fiancé, Stuart Long, had planned to fly from Atlanta to Minneapolis, where they would be picked up by the Ramsey plane, and then they'd all proceed to Charlevoix. John asked Mike to reach them at the Minneapolis airport and have them divert to Denver. John's oldest daughter, Elizabeth, called Beth, had been killed in an automobile accident in Chicago with her friend Matt Darrington on June 8, 1992, when she was 22. John had been devastated by the loss of Beth, going into an extended mourning, but by his own account had come out of the ordeal with his faith renewed and strengthened. The Beechcraft plane was named for Beth. Police officers began questioning the Ramseys, trying to piece together an official version of the story. Both of them thought all doors had been locked the previous night. According to Steve Thomas's account, there was some discrepancy in Patsy's story as to whether she'd checked JonBenet's room and found it empty, which had prompted her to go downstairs looking for her and found the note, or whether she had found the note first and then gone to the bedroom to check. While this could be significant if Patsy was, in fact, still working on getting her story straight, I have generally found that parents of child victims often don't remember details of their own actions during these times of fear and stress. I have seen parents block out the entire experience, the way you hear of car crash victims being unable to recall anything about the accident. Both parents remembered leaving the White's house about 8:30 in the evening, making two brief stops to leave gifts at the houses of other friends, and returning home shortly after 9. JonBenet fell asleep in the car, and John carried her into the house and upstairs to her room, where Patsy got her ready for bed. They said she did not wake up during any of this. John then went to attend to Burke, but the boy insisted on completing assembly of a Christmas toy. By the time John put him to bed and came up to his own bedroom, a converted attic space on the third floor, Patsy was already in bed. John took a melatonin tablet to help him sleep and set the alarm clock for 5:30 a.m. The detectives asked John if he could think of anyone who might have taken JonBenet or might wish him harm. The first person he thought of was Jeff Merrick, a longtime Access Graphics employee who had been let go and was apparently extremely bitter about it. He had filed a complaint with Lockheed Martin, and John was told by several people that Merrick had threatened to bring down both him and Access. Patsy's first thought when asked a similar question was Linda Hoffman Pugh, their housekeeper. Patsy said Linda had been acting strangely and had asked to borrow $2,500 because she couldn't pay her rent. Patsy also recalled that her own mother, Nedra Paw, had told her that Linda had once remarked, "JonBenet is so pretty. Aren't you afraid that someone might kidnap her?" The police sent officers out to interview Hoffman Pugh and her husband in nearby Fort Lupton. In the meantime, the 8-10 window in which the kidnapper had said he would call had come and gone, unless, John Ramsey recalled thinking, it referred to the next day. Since they didn't know exactly when the crime had taken place, before or after midnight, John could not be sure. At one point, John was seen going through the mail, and the rumor surfaced that he had left the house to go get it. In fact, the mail came into the house through a slot in the front door. Several people have commented on the apparent nonchalance and detachment this demonstrates, but John says that he was anxious to see if there was any communication from the kidnapper. By lunchtime, no word had come, and the various police officials began leaving the house and returning to the station to work the case. The two victim advocates had also gone. This left Detective Linda Arndt as the only police officer at the scene to supervise 7 civilians, John and Patsy Ramsey, Fleet and Priscilla White, who had returned after taking Burke to their house to be watched, John and Barbara Fernie, and the Reverend Rawl Hoverstock. Arndt was clearly uncomfortable with this arrangement and called Detective Sergeant Larry Mason for backup. For whatever reason, possibly due to the holiday-thinned staffing roster, none came. In what may have been an attempt to keep John occupied while she was dealing with everyone by herself, around 1 in the afternoon, Arndt asked him to take one of the other men and look through the house to see if they could find anything new or possibly related to the crime. John asked Fleet White to accompany him and suggested that they begin in the basement and work their way up. The Wine Cellar. John and Fleet went through the basement room by room. Past the table set up with Burke's electric trains, they came upon the broken window, where they found several small splinters of glass on the floor. John figured these were probably still from his unusual entry the previous summer. It certainly seems odd in retrospect not to have fixed the window in all those months, But this was a low-crime area. The Ramseys also had a burglar alarm but had not used it for months because the children kept accidentally setting it off. John and Fleet noticed a suitcase resting near the window. If there had been an intruder and the window was his point of exit, he could have used it as a step. But since the two men moved it in their search, it would be difficult to say. They looked through the crawl spaces under the dining room, then retraced their steps into the furnace room, coming to the wine cellar door that Fleet had looked in earlier and found pitch black. But as soon as John opened the door, he saw something and, according to White, screamed, "Oh my God, oh my God!" John raced in and found JonBenet lying on her back on the floor with a white blanket wrapped around her torso. Her hands were stretched over her head, tightly bound with thin cord. A piece of black duct tape covered her mouth. Next to her body was one of her favorite pink nightgowns. Fleet touched JonBenet's ankle. It was cold. He turned and raced up the stairs for help. John knelt down over her, ripped the tape from her mouth, pulled off the blanket, and began trying to loosen the wrist binding. All the while he said he begged her to talk to him. Her eyes were closed. He picked her up and carried her stiff body upright around the waist, up the stairs into the living room where Linda Arndt was. Fleet had already come upstairs and shouted for someone to call an ambulance. John laid JonBenet on the floor next to the Christmas tree, uttering words of comfort while Arndt checked for vital signs. But the detective could see that the child was in full rigor mortis and her lips were blue. Fleet then went back to the basement where he picked up the piece of duct tape. That made two people who had now handled it. Before Patsy came back into the room, John covered JonBenet's body with another blanket, as if he were tucking her into bed. The Reverend Raul Hoverstock saw what was happening and began praying out loud. When he completed his prayer, he informed John that he had performed the last rites of the Episcopal Church over JonBenet. There are conflicting versions of what Patsy did at this point. According to Steve Thomas's account, which presumably came from his fellow police officers, as soon as Fleet came upstairs shouting, Priscilla White and Barbara Fernie hurried toward the sound, while Patsy did not move from the couch in the sunroom. She came in a few moments later supported by her friends. According to John Ramsey's account, Patsy essentially fought her way into the living room, rushing past him and falling onto JonBenet's body, screaming and crying hysterically. It is then generally agreed that she implored Hoverstock, with something to the effect of, "Jesus, you raised Lazarus from the dead. Raise my baby from the dead." Whatever the exact timing or sequence was, at one moment John Ramsey and Linda Arndt were face to face kneeling over JonBenet's body. It was right after Arndt had searched in vain for a pulse, and John asked her if his daughter was still alive. She looked him in the eye and told him that JonBenet was dead. John emitted a low groan of anguish. Now, here the narrative gets strange. John and Patsy were both feeling that Arndt had been extremely solicitous and sensitive toward them, and continued to feel so throughout the agonized afternoon and the days ahead. Other members of the police department apparently had the same impression. In fact, at some later point, certain other detectives were annoyed that Patsy would speak with Arndt, but not with them. But 3 years after these events, when she had left the Boulder police force, Arndt recalled the scene differently when she appeared on a nationally broadcast television program. "And as we looked at each other, I remember, and I wore a shoulder holster, tucking my gun right next to me and consciously counting, 'I've got 18 bullets, because I didn't know if we'd all be alive when people showed up.'" She went on to say, "Everything made sense in that instance, and I knew what happened." The implication, I think it's generally agreed, is that what she felt happened was that John had killed his daughter, or had at least taken part in the killing, or the cover-up. To my way of thinking, this is an extremely peculiar statement on many levels. For one, none of it ever went into Arndt's reports. Second, she apparently continued to treat the Ramseys well, not giving any indication that she felt she was dealing with suspects rather than grieving parents. Third, even if John Ramsey was going to attack her right then and there, what's this about having to count 18 bullets? There were only 7 people in the house beside herself, and none of them was armed. I set great store in gathering impressions through face-to-face contact, but what kind of evidence is this? She saw murder in his eyes? I would tend to chalk up this reaction to the profound stress of having to deal with the situation on her own without any support, having the dead child found right in the house after police searches had missed her, and realizing, therefore, that the crime scene was coming apart before her eyes. Even her former fellow officers found the statement curious. From kidnapping to murder. As the case suddenly turned from kidnapping to murder, Linda Arndt directed John to call 911 again. When that didn't provide immediate results, she called twice more on her own. She would soon get the backup she'd been requesting. More police, an FBI special agent from the Denver field office, the fire department, and an ambulance with paramedics. Boulder Police Chief Thomas Kobe called Detective Commander John Eller and told him his help was urgently needed. Amidst the new clamor and turmoil, Detective Sergeant Larry Mason asked John Ramsey his plans. John's instincts were to get the family back to Atlanta, where their parents and his brother Jeff were, and where he already knew he wanted to bury his daughter, near Beth in the cemetery in Marietta, Georgia. Mason told him the family should stay in the area at least for several days. According to John, he said they would. The police say they overheard a telephone conversation in which John told Mike to prepare the plane to fly to Atlanta and considered it suspicious that he'd want to get out of town so quickly. If, in fact, it did happen that way, I see nothing suspicious in it. This is a man used to being able to control things who wants to get to the comfort and relative safety of the place he considers his real home. The police now wanted the house cleared. One of the Fernies suggested that the Ramseys go to the Fernies' house in South Boulder. Just as they were leaving through the front door, around 2:15, a taxi pulled up with John Andrew and Melinda Ramsey and Stuart Long, who'd taken the first flight they could from Minnesota after getting the message from Mike Archuleta. John went to them and told them, "JonBenet is gone." Everyone erupted in a new flood of tears. At about the same time, Detective Thomas Trujillo arrived with a consent to search form, which he handed to Larry Mason, who asked John to sign it. He did so, later saying he thought he was signing a consent form for an autopsy to be performed on JonBenet. Then the Ramseys drove to the Fernies' home, where Fleet White would bring Burke, and where they would have a 24-hour police guard. What they didn't know at the time was that those officers would be trying to listen to every word they said. Though, in retrospect, the scene was already hopelessly compromised, detectives went about the collection of evidence. The most crucial piece was the ransom note itself, which fortunately had already been taken in and preserved. Sergeant Whitson had asked the Ramseys for handwriting exemplars to compare with the note, and John had quickly given him two white, lined legal tablets. One had been lying on the kitchen countertop and contained Patsy's notes, doodles, and shopping lists. The other was on a table in the hallway not far from the spiral staircase on which Patsy had found the note, and contained John's writings. Whitson marked the top sheets John and Patsy. The two pads were taken to the police department and given to Detective Jeff Kithcart, the forgery and fraud expert. As he was going through Patsy's pad, Kithcart noticed something extraordinary. Toward the middle of the tablet, a few words were written on a page in black, felt-tip pen. Mr. and Mrs., along with a single downstroke that could easily have been the beginning of a capital R. The paper appeared the same as the one on which the ransom note was written. Apparently, this was a first draft, and after consideration, the writer had decided to address the note to Mr. Ramsey only. What this meant, of course, is that police could now say with a fair degree of certainty that the three-page ransom note was written in the Ramsey house, using their own pad and paper. This narrowed the scenario considerably. Either an intruder or intruders had spent a fair amount of time in the house undiscovered, or JonBenet had been killed by one or more of the three individuals known to be in the house at the same time, John, Patsy, and Burke. When a child is murdered in or near the home, the parents and close family members are always high on the initial suspect list. Statistics tell us they are the likely killers. As a rule of thumb, the younger the child, the more probable a family member was involved. This was certainly well known to Special Agent Ron Walker of the Bureau's Denver field office, who had been called in to consult on the case. There are few people in law enforcement for whom I have a higher regard than Ron, For one thing, I trained him in profiling and criminal investigative analysis at Quantico and found him to be a natural. For another, he saved my life. In December of 1983, when I had lapsed into a coma in my Seattle hotel room from viral encephalitis while working on the Green River murders, it had been Ron and fellow agent Blaine McElwain who had gotten worried when they couldn't reach me and broken down the door and rescued me. Ron advised the Boulder police to look closely at the parents. This was the highest percentage shot in a case like this. He also pledged whatever assistance from the FBI the police would like. Similar offers would soon come from Denver PD and the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. Just so we get this straight, since the passage of the Lindbergh Law, the FBI has primary jurisdiction in a kidnapping case. But once a body is found, it becomes a local matter because homicide is a state crime. Then the Bureau can do no more than offer whatever assistance the local agency wishes to have. The FBI can provide an evidence response team, profiling and criminal investigative analysis, lab facilities, legal advice, major case computer management, cover out-of-state leads and liaison, whatever. But they have to be requested. Unfortunately, none of these services was used early on to an extent that could have made a difference in the investigation. This is an important consideration in all of law enforcement. Just as in medicine, where doctors refer patients to other doctors with specialty training in a given field, no law enforcement official is going to be expert in everything. And the smaller and less experienced the department, the less specialized expertise they're going to have. This is completely understandable, and there is no shame in it. What is understandable but not acceptable is when a department refuses to accept assistance from another agency that does have the expertise and the experience. The Boulder PD was, and is, full of dedicated, hard-working officers. But it is also true, as well as fortunate, that the city has only suffered, on average, a single homicide a year. Regardless of their dedication, there's no way they could have the depth to work a homicide the way a major department such as New York or Denver could. Evidently, this one looked pretty straightforward to them, even though the crime scene itself was already a mess. I've had it both ways, and I've often found that when a local department calls us in willingly and early, as opposed to when the investigation has already gone south and the media and the public are screaming for results, it means that the guy or woman in charge generally has a fair degree of self-confidence and therefore is not threatened by outsiders trying to help. Two out of many such individuals who come immediately to mind are Lexington County, South Carolina Sheriff Jim Metz, who asked for my unit's assistance when a young woman and a little girl were abducted from in front of their houses, and Rochester, New York Police Captain Lynd Johnson, who asked us to help solve a series of prostitute murders. I personally worked the South Carolina case on scene, and my associate Greg McCrary went up to Rochester. In both cases, a highly effective working relationship between local law enforcement and the FBI led to successful apprehensions and trials. I wish the same had happened in Boulder. Linda Arndt and Larry Mason came back to the Fernies' house several times the following day to talk to the Ramseys. At one point, Arndt asked John and Patsy to come down to the police station and answer questions more formally. I don't mean to implicate either officer, but it was probably around this time that the antagonism and animosity between the Ramseys and Boulder police really took root, and I don't think it was the conscious doing of either side. Patsy was distraught, heavily sedated, and proclaiming she wanted to die. John didn't feel she was in any shape to leave the house and be subjected to the rigors of a police interview. The police had a high-profile murder investigation on their hands, the kind that often or usually ends up with parental involvement, and they wanted to lock the parents each into his or her own story. The Ramsey's friend Michael Bynum was at the Fernies paying a condolence call when Linda Arndt made the interview request of John. Bynum was an attorney who had been a prosecutor in the Boulder District Attorney's Office and was now in private practice with a large local firm. He told John he was wary of how they were now being treated by the police and asked if John and Patsy would trust him to make some decisions on their behalf. John said he was only too grateful to have the help of a close friend. Bynum immediately told the police that the Ramseys would not be going down to the police station to be interviewed at this time because he didn't feel they were in shape for it. Then he contacted Brian Morgan, a prominent Denver attorney and one of the name partners of Haddon, Morgan, and Foreman, and asked him to represent John. Bynum got another attorney, Patrick Burke, to represent Patsy. Bynum had enough experience with the criminal justice system to believe that anyone who became enmeshed with it needed to be personally represented by counsel. Postmortem. The postmortem exam was conducted by Dr. John E. Meyer, a pathologist and coroner of Boulder County. Meyer had been called to the Ramsey House around 8 p.m. on December 26th to conduct a brief examination and officially pronounce JonBenet dead. During that 10-minute look, he noted a ligature around the right wrist and, when the body was turned over, another around the neck, so tight it had dug a furrow into the skin. It was a garrote, knotted in the back, and fastened to a broken 4-inch stick that had been used to tighten it. JonBenet was wearing a gold cross and chain, which were tangled in the ligature. A small area of abrasion or contusion was on the cheek near the right ear, and a prominent dried abrasion was on the lower left side of the neck. The broken stick turned out to be part of a paintbrush handle from Patsy's painting kit in the basement. The kit itself was right outside the wine cellar door, meaning it was the first handy implement the killer would have noticed. JonBenet was wearing long underwear over floral print panties, both of which were stained with urine. A red stain consistent with blood was also in the crotch of her panties. At the time, it was believed that semen deposits were found in the panties and on her leg. This report later turned out to be erroneous. The actual autopsy took place in the coroner's lab in the basement of the Boulder Community Hospital. In addition to the observations he made at the house, Meyer noted tiny petechial hemorrhages on the eyelids. Further hemorrhaging appeared on either side of the ligature furrow around the neck. Dried blood was found around the entrance to the vagina, as well as hyperemia, or engorged blood vessels, indicating possible trauma in the tissue around and just inside the vagina. The hymen was not intact, and abrasions along the vaginal wall were visible. The fingernails were clipped for lab analysis. Meyer reported occasional scattered petechial hemorrhaging on the surface of each lung and the anterior surface of the heart. When he made an incision and pulled back the scalp, Meyer saw a large, 7x4-inch, area of hemorrhage on the right side. Underneath was an even larger skull fracture, approximately 8.5 inches long. A thin film of subarachnoid hemorrhage, that is, bleeding under the membrane covering the brain, overlay the entire right cerebral hemisphere. Underneath, the gray matter of the brain itself was bruised. The small intestine contained fragmented pieces of semi-digested fruit that Meyer believed might be pineapple. This detail became important in the investigation because neither John nor Patsy recalled JonBenet's eating anything after they left the Whites. In fact, she fell asleep in the car and did not wake up when John carried her upstairs or when Patsy prepared her for bed. Yet the state of the pineapple in the intestines suggested it was eaten that day or evening, and a bowl with cut pineapple was noted in the Ramsey kitchen. The bowl was processed for prints. Patsy's and Burke's were found, but not JonBenet's. Police picked this out as an inconsistency in Patsy's story. Patsy and John said they were perplexed by the finding and had no explanation for it. I would expect guilty people to come up with some explanation. The bottom line was that JonBenet had been strangled with a garrote-style ligature and had suffered massive blunt force trauma to the right side of her head. Though there was and still is some question about which injury occurred first, either would have been sufficient to kill her. The petechial hemorrhages on the insides of the eyelids, as well as other places, coupled with the lack of substantial bleeding from the head wound, suggests that the strangulation was first, so that by the time of the head injury, her heart was no longer pumping, or was pumping only weakly. The official cause of death was listed as asphyxia by strangulation associated with craniocerebral trauma. Evidence. Everything that had touched JonBenet's body was collected. Clothing, the blankets, even the silk blouse and jeans Linda Arndt was wearing when she had leaned over the dead child. In the house, police technicians reviewed the scene in the basement where the body was discovered and the area around the broken window. There were pieces of glass outside the window and a scuff mark on the wall. During this search, Detective Michael Everett found Patsy's painting box, from which the wooden stick used in the garage had come. Splinters on the floor next to the box indicated that this was where it had been broken. It was then logical to surmise that here or near here was where the garroting had taken place, rather than upstairs in the bedroom. On the second floor, in the bathroom off JonBenet's bedroom, investigators found a balled-up red turtleneck, which Patsy said JonBenet had been wearing when she went to bed. No one seemed to know how it ended up there. Next to the spiral staircase and opposite JonBenet's bedroom, there was a stacked washer-dryer unit and laundry room-type wall cabinets. One of the cabinets was open with a package of pull-up diapers visible. This seemed odd in a household with a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old, but JonBenet, advanced for her age in most other ways, had a fairly chronic problem with wetting the bed and, to a lesser extent, her pants. The bedwetting was so common that Linda Hoffman Pugh reported that before she even got to work in the morning, Patsy would routinely strip JonBenet's bedsheets and put them into the washer-dryer. The bedwetting became critical in the investigation because it suggested a possible motive for one parent and hinted at possible behavior from the other. It would be suggested that Patsy had accidentally fatally injured her daughter when she lost it with her over the bedwetting. It would also be suggested that JonBenet's wetting and occasional soiling were a reaction to sexual advances and abuse by her father. The police also searched the area surrounding the house. What kind of people are they? Several things happened in relatively quick succession that helped open a seemingly unbridgeable rift between the Ramseys and the police, and ultimately created the enduring public perception of the couple. First of all, the statistics point